Welcome to the Tech Talks Daily Podcast, where you can learn and be inspired by real-world examples of how technology is transforming businesses and reshaping industries in a language everyone can understand. Here is your host, Neil C. Hughes.
Welcome back to the Tech Talks Daily Podcast. Now, whatever you do for a living, do you look up to tech geniuses such as Steve Jobs or Elon Musk in awe and think there's no way that someone like you is capable of that or building the next Amazon out of your garage like Jeff Bezos did? Well, with the rise of imposter syndrome, which, believe me, is something that I know all too well, I wanted to know more about how an average Joe or Joanne could be the Silicon Valley tech genius of the future. And guess what? There is a book by Sean Livermore on that exact topic. And the book covers numerous tech entrepreneurial founders and software developers and the exciting brands or products that they created and the stories behind them. And the book dives in deep on a handful of them, narrowly divulging exactly how a few software developers and startup founders created breakthrough tech products such as Gmail, Dropbox, Snapchat, Bitcoin, Groupon, and so many more. And what I love is how it highlights and unpacks the general hero worship that the media and maybe our own minds practice about tech founders and tech entrepreneurs. And that idealization of tech success can create a paradox which prevents average tech professionals from advancing their own successful journeys. So buckle up and hold on tight so I can beam your ears all the way to the US so we can speak with Sean about his Amazon best-selling business non-fiction book, Average Joe, and how maybe you too could be the next Silicon Valley tech genius. So a massive warm welcome to the show. Can you tell the listeners a little about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Great to be here. My name is Sean. I'm a tech consultant working under the company Product Perfect. You can check us out at productperfect.com. And I help to build and consult for enterprises across the United States here. And my focus has been of late in launching the book Average Joe and seeing that kind of take shape. And excited to hit the bestsellers list and looking to get back on that list very soon here.
And I'm glad you mentioned bestsellers list there, because like you said, you are the author of the Amazon best-selling business nonfiction book, Average Joe. And you help people learn how to think, speak, and create like a tech genius. But I've got to ask, where did the inspiration for this book come from?
21 years in the technology industry has taught me that we do things a little bit backwards. And the reason we do that is because we have this archetype in our minds of this tech genius, you know, this magic dust that technology professionals and founders of companies that seemingly magically go viral overnight, they seem to have this uncanny ability to speak gold, right? They just open their mouth and they raise millions of dollars. They sit down to type and their code is perfect, you know, and their apps go viral and everything they do just works. When in reality, the opposite is true. It's yes, there are some gifted individuals, but by and large, more often than not, it's a series of layers and iterations and plateaus. And, you know, that overnight success debunking is part of the myth. But then, you know, the inspiration kind of came in my own journey as I went through the process of raising six rounds of venture funding and seeing my startups kind of win and then lose and win and lose and going through the roller coaster of that, and then sort of return to consulting afterward and looking from the outside in and helping to speak life into dormant ears that and souls that I believe have sort of missed it, and trying to get them back in the game to go for it once again. So it's kind of a personal passion of encouragement, I suppose.
And if we do look at the tech industry and big names such as Steve Jobs or Elon Musk, there is almost this worship of intelligence in tech, but which is also something that you cover in the book. But can you expand on that and how it's shaping the industry?
Yeah, there's this kind of PhDs hiring PhDs, you know, at Google and others. They're not the only ones, but yeah. You know, they get kind of caught up in intelligence and IQ scores and psychometrics, and they make you answer silly questions in interviews that, you know, literally if you Google it, you'll find some, you know, why are manholes round questions, you know, and they're looking for ways of very quickly weeding out people who are not supremely intelligent. Now, don't get me wrong. I think, you know, it's good to have a brain in your head, and you should never shy away from using what God has given you. But I think at the same time, we discount ourselves. If we don't have an insane high IQ, then of course we're not worthy. And I think people, like if you go on any message boards, I remember the founder of Linux, Linus Torvalds, had gone on some rants, and not just him, not to single him out, but there in the book, we talk about kind of how these rants on forums for software really uncover this cyberbullying mentality, this exclusivity model that, you know, you're not on the inside, you're on the outside, you know. And then we have situations that arise from that, like imposter syndrome and, you know, career stifling situations. And at first glance, it's, well, that's not my problem, so I'm not worried about it. But actually, a lot of the listeners of this podcast will go through it. If you haven't gone through it yet, you will go through a few cycles of your career where you are the odd man out. You're not the smartest guy in the room, and they're looking at you like maybe you don't belong here, right? And so the issue of worship and of intelligence in the tech industry and around the tech industry also is an inhibitor and a precursor to exclusivity, and prohibits the expansion of the tech industry, because we're too good for everyone else. We're too smart. We don't let anyone in, right? And hey, you're not welcome here is the message that the rest of the world gets. So I think the opposite of true, you know, all are welcome here. And if you want to learn how to code, or if you want to have any sort of technical prowess, go for it, is kind of the walk away moment of the book. But narcissism and, you know, majoring on the minors, you know, really nitpicking people, tearing them apart, it's counterproductive, it's counterintuitive, and it stifles culture. It really kills having diversity and a multiplicity of color at various levels in your organization.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that, because I think I would say that most people listening have seen examples of some of those Google interview type questions there. And I don't know, it just feels a little bit dated almost, especially when you're thinking about a world where we need greater inclusivity and diversity of thought. Having an interview question where it just ends up with a workforce of everyone that thinks the same is, like you say, counterproductive. And one of the things I like about your book is it explains that myth of the tech genius. But can you expand on your idea that the tech industry and the media, along with it, in fact, have actually embraced and even venerated certain tech founders, while the typical tech engineer slumps and languishes in obscurity? Because I think that is something that will resonate with a lot of people listening too.
Totally. You know, and it all goes back to 1840, a Scottish philosopher named Thomas Carlyle published about 80,000 words across 20 volumes on one key idea called great man theory. And great man theory basically tells it the narrative that all men seek to worship, right? We look to venerate, and all women. And so humanity itself seeks out princes and princesses and kings and queens. You know, we love the idea of Harry and Meghan, and Americans out here, I know you Brits, you're kind of like, well, they're there, we know they're there, whatever, you know. We give a little bit of our GDP to them, and they have a castle and a few extra security guards, and we're not worried about them. But here in America, we love Meghan and Harry. In fact, we're so glad they're here in Los Angeles area. Kind of feels like there's this halo effect, and my wife and her friends, you know, they gab about it, you know. But that royalty model extends into tech. And so we have our own royalty, don't we? We have Elon Musk. We have Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs. We have so many others. And Bezos, whether you love him or hate him or fear him, you know, he's royalty. And the great man theory goes all the way back and looks at Scandinavian Norse god Odin, who would empower Vikings on the battlefield, who would then, where we get the word berserk from, because they would become what they called berserkers, because they were impervious to injury and would be able to strike down their enemy with the power of Odin, you know. And that this is not something I made up. This is truth. It's literally what they believed, evidentially, and then expanded centuries beyond that. And so the great man theory of Carlyle continued to replicate and influence other writings, and You know, investors look at things the same way. They want to know if he comes from good stock. You know, they use phrases that are preclusive and prohibitive and exclusive, and they look to outline a circle around the founder to say, are they in or out of a circle, right? And they're looking to invest money. They're looking to have a return and have a good narrative to tell about this guy. Well, he came from an Ivy League school. His parents are lawyers, and boy, they came from money and they know what they're doing, and they know they got a lot of friends, right? Well, what does that sound like? That doesn't sound like innovation, right? That sounds like Rockefeller and the oil, barons of 100 years ago. I mean, so it's a weird juxtaposition that tech can find itself in. But if you play that game of hero worship, if you play that game of the tech genius, you're going to lose, because you're putting yourself in a binary switch moment where either I am or am not acceptable. And it's not really a security issue. I'm very happy with my career and very happy with my own skill set. I'm very lucky and fortunate, and I'm thankful. But when I look at those around me, even talking to my daughter who's in college about her future, and she's thinking through things, and I'm like, man, the tech industry has not really laid the red carpet out for others to join, right? And it really should rethink that marketing pitch. And I think, you know, Forbes and Fast Company, Inc. magazine, Fortune magazine, you know, you walk by at the airport or at any bookstore, you see all these magazines of these tech founders and their halo effect and their glory and all their honor and wisdom and might, you know, and all the tweets and all the followers, right? And it's kind of like their own Kardashian crew. And so we certainly got to watch to not get caught up in that, because, Tony Stark is just an idea about Iron Man. We get carried away, right? It's not like Elon Musk goes and puts a suit on and flies through the air himself in an Iron Man suit, right? It's a little ridiculous. So, but that's the great man theory. In the book, in a very satisfying and unexpected twist, sort of, it tells you, well, there's no such thing as a tech genius, but then halfway through, it kind of switches it on you and says, well, actually, you can kind of become a tech genius yourself. And if you follow these steps, here's how to do it, right?
And one of the things that I try and do on this podcast is bust a few myths. And one of the big ones that's always frustrated me is the myth that only creative people can innovate, and especially if you put them in a room of multicolored beanbags and foosball tables. But what I love about your book is it also dispels the myth that only the mysterious tech geniuses can actually possess that creativity and intellectual power. But the twist in the book is what I really love, and that is that it empowers the reader to become the myth themselves. But can you expand on that core message that you wanted to deliver in the book?
Yes, I can. It spans from two key concepts, and one is intelligence, the other is creativity. And so we talked a little bit about genius and how that really isn't a factor in most of the cases. The other side of that is the creative side. And most developers and brainy kind of left brainers, they self-characterize as not being creative. Well, obviously that's not true. The, you know, code and software development and technology product creation itself is very creative. In fact, it's one of the most creative things you can try to do. If you've ever tried to code, or if you're a software engineer out there, you know, you're creating classes and paradigms, inversion of control. I mean, you're doing things architecturally, inheritance, implementing interfaces. I mean, all these weird concepts, polymorphic models. You know, if people sat down and heard two developers talking about some of the stuff they're doing, they'd just zone out. Their eyes would glaze over. They'd have no idea what they were talking about. It's very creative. And the naming of our variables, all the way to how we structure, and then we get tighter and tighter with our code. I think that we sort of point to the other side of the department and say, well, the creatives sit over there, you know, the graphic designers and all the people who work with colors. If you ask me about colors, I'm going to go blank on you. Don't, you know, my wife paints the walls and I earn the money, you know. And there's, of course, I'm sorry, that was a gender specific statement. Just saying, generally speaking, a lot of development is really, really unfairly critiqued, where creativity is a process, it's not a person. And the bursts of genius and the level of creative juice that you try to associate with creativity in general typically is unfair and undeserved. When you look at products like Slack, for example, that just sold to Salesforce for $27 billion, you know, when that was first created, it was sort of a backup plan. It was a pivot. And of course, MetaLab came in and designed the product for Stuart Butterfield, who was failing on his game company, Stitch, I think it was called. And then that designed product got a lot of attention for several reasons. One, he was in the Valley and he knew people. Two, he already had the attention of the media, having sold his company Flickr to Yahoo for like $25 million. So he had a decent exit. And then he jump-started that to the next big thing. And I think there was a little bit of design magic that happened. But the essence of this tech genius and having this magic touch and, you know, being creative and having all the right stuff, it really wasn't there. It was more aligned with a procedural nature of a founder with good investors, with a good board that was giving good advice and then making good decisions about bringing in good people who were talented and who had a lot of experience to create a beautiful product. And then they saw the product through to the end and they got great media attention. And it was product market fit. So I think there's a lot that goes into debunking the myth and really unpacking what creativity really is and how it has an impact. You know, Albert Einstein said that creativity is intelligence just having fun.
You also explore the backstories of tech icons and big brands such as Snapchat, Slack, Uber, Google, Gmail, Groupon, Bitcoin, WeWork, etc. But I'm curious, from all those backstories that you explored, were there any trends and what did you learn from those stories? Is there any magic dust or secret sauce?
You know, they're all so different. They're all really so different. I mean, you know, take Dropbox, for example. You know, the guy, Drew Houston, gets on a bus, says, "Oh shoot, I forgot my thumb drives," you know, and he pulls his laptop out and he gets this idea. "Oh shoot, that's a great idea for a startup. What if we had all of our data in the cloud and I would just log in and get access to my thumb drives from here, from anywhere? And then what if I synced it?" Right. Well, it wasn't an original idea. There were 11 different file backup products on the market. But the way that they were approaching file backup was not quite calibrated the way Drew had thought about file backup. And he thought of it more like a synchronization. So you look at Groupon, there were the ability to get an online coupon, but not in the way that others would participate in the transaction, right? So the village mindset was the big idea of Groupon, is that others are willing. They're willing to participate in each other's transactions. When before we thought it to be very private, very isolated, like, "I don't want you to know what I'm buying on the internet." You know, now it's like everybody should know and let's stick it to the man, you know, and go on it together. You know, you think of Gmail and the founding of that, Paul Buchheit, who in college in 1996 had already created the Gmail product, but then stepped away from it, tabled the whole code base, let it go, then got hired by Google and thought Google would get its butt kicked from Excite and Alta Vista, which we're all laughing now. But he said, "Hey, well, even if I join and it fails, I'll still make friends and they'll lead me to my next job." Well, it didn't fail, obviously. He was employee number 24, 27, something like that. And he, I think, made $500 million off of that decision. So, but when he created Gmail, the notion he went under was JavaScript is bad when he joined, right? Everyone's afraid of JavaScript. If you think back at Y2K, if you're old enough listening to this podcast, Y2K was the bug when the turn of the year 2000 would come that all these computers would stop working. So everyone's freaking out, you know, and, "Oh God, we got to fix Y2K." And so around that time, JavaScript was really scary. It was like evil, right? So he had to slay the JavaScript dragons and really fight against the trend to bring JavaScript into a web-based email product and get people to believe in JavaScript. Now, all three of those examples I just gave were not, you know, it's not brain science. They were just kind of pulling in theories, philosophies, beliefs, notions, what a venture capitalist Mike Maples calls inflections. There are four types, and the book goes into that, but they pulled in their inflection into their work, and then they did really high quality work. Of course, they had great people skilled, experienced people around them from a design and development perspective. I don't even know if Groupon was well architected or well designed, but it had that village mindset philosophy. And so that was the triggering point and the element that sent it viral. But there are many other examples we go into, but I think the debunking of that is to encourage us to say, look, if you learn philosophies around, like cognitive mechanisms, there's like 11 core cognitive mechanisms in chapter 7 we go into, talk about how Snapchat was able to dominate and go viral. And we look at Flappy Bird, the game, this weird, obscure game that just overnight went from nothing to this global phenomenon and then disappeared again later. You know, it's just this weird thing. But they are all based on these cognitive mechanisms and dopamine and, you know, cortisol and different brain chemistry items that come together. So yes, there are a few things that do overlap. If you study, there's a great TED talk that talks about why tech startups succeed. What are the commonalities? And the one commonality it found was timing, which is weird to think, well, how do I get timing right? Well, I don't know. You sort of have to study the game a little bit and be in the game to get it right, right? Proximity. So if you're proximal to people who are doing great work and learning great lessons, you're going to learn those yourselves. It'll be caught, not taught, right? So you catch the virus, so to speak. Sorry, terrible timing for that analogy, but you get in the room and you get somewhere. You know, you scrape out a victory.
I think that timing thing is so bang on the money there. And after 1,400 interviews on here, the amount of being in the right place at the right time kind of stories, happy accidents, it all almost happens by accident. But at the same time, feels like the universe gives you that nudge in the right direction so you're where you need to be at that right place. Mm-hmm. But if we do have any wannabe tech founders, creative geniuses or innovators stifled by their own views or limitations, and especially when they keep looking up to these mysterious tech geniuses, personas, which is possibly an illusion, what kind of advice would you offer them?
Well, in the book, the answer to that is the whole book, because but we do kind of take them through a smelly tunnel where we start at the very beginning of I'm caught up in my own little world. I don't know how to communicate, and I'm not sure if why my idea is not getting traction or people don't really get me. I'm misunderstood. And we take them through the whole process of debunking the myth, expanding their intellectual notions, expanding their creative capabilities with the Slow Create framework, a creativity framework I developed with a PhD professor of neuroscience out of University of California, Los Angeles, here in the United States. And then we take them through the process of understanding how these other startups did it. And then toward the end of the book, we teach them how to communicate. So every day I try to improve my communication. I try to improve the crystallization of my vision and my ideas. But there's a triad that I've created. And in that triangular shape, it's a quick little reference point. On the bottom edge, it says interesting problems. And I would also say the right problems. You know, are you solving interesting problems? And interesting is a big word. Do investors find that interesting? Not does your cousin find it interesting or your coworker, does an investor find it interesting? Is the problem big enough for a large scale solution and where they can throw $1 billion at it to really save it for the whole world, to solve it for the whole world? On the left side of the triangle is a narrow focus. Are you scoped very, very laser focused to that one particular area? And are you the best in the world at solving that area? And on the right side is articulate speech. And the word articulate is not just speaking without the word or stutters, but is to use other techniques. And we go over some of the techniques in the book and also on the website, slowcreate.com, or the book website, averagejoetechgenius.com. There's 26 videos on the website. You can watch them all for free. On that right side, articulate speech, we have a method, API, analogy, portrayal, inversion. So learning the API method, allowing yourself to take your subject matter, the patterns, the details, the secrets, all the things your hands are working through in the clay, the skin cells are rubbing off in the clay as you work your your subject matter, and be able to rise up from the details and speak intelligently, clearly and crisply to family, friends, investors, where they look at you in the eye and they go, wow, that's amazing, right? And we call that the fascination, the moment of fascination. And it's this inflection point where they hear the gravity of the situation. It's almost like a pitch, right? Where you state the customer problem, you state the pain, you dig the knife to say how bad that pain really is. But hey, there's a solution. You raise your hand and say, we're the ones that are solving it. Here's how we're solving it. We've got all these partners around us and look at all the progress we've made. And we're about to go blow up the world with this solution. You should invest. But it's taking the model of a pitch, the skeleton of a pitch, and applying it to like 12 words. And how do you do that? Well, you find a way to crystallize, to organize, and to communicate and articulate. And that's what Chapter 10, the sustainable mystique model is. And so usually people come back after reading that and say, wow, that actually really helped me recalibrate how I was talking about my work. Whether your work is a brilliant new startup or whether it's you're a soccer parent and you're looking for a way to organize the kids as they get ready for practice or whatever it might be, usually it's a little more on the sophisticated side, but you know, you can use this technique throughout your work, regardless of who you are.
Well, here we are in 2021 and a lot of people talking about the latest tech trends and predictions for the year ahead. And we're all, of course, hoping it's going to be much more positive than last year. But are there any tech trends that particularly excite or intrigue you that you're going to be following closely this year?
I think it will be interesting to see where artificial intelligence takes us. There's a lot of work that we do with email, you know, the grunge work where every time you hit a keystroke and you're like, should I be doing this right now? You know, think AI. I think there's going to be some developments there. I think labor arbitrage will take another leap forward. I think everyone being on Zoom with COVID has taught the world a great lesson that they can save a ton of money on office space. So I think that will be a shift. Office space will probably change. A little more fluidity in the market, perhaps. And I'm not sure why Bitcoin is rallying so much. I am close to a couple financial advisors and they're looking at it, shaking their heads like there's no true usage in the market when it takes 2 minutes to process a Bitcoin transaction. Maybe I'm ignorant to this, but I think Ethereum and some of the other cryptos are gonna kind of shoot up because of it, that when we start using Bitcoin, they'll realize, what are we doing? This doesn't work well. You know, I think all the people on the inside, they already know that, but the rest of the world hasn't quite accepted it yet, you know?
Yeah. And what about yourself, though? What's next for you? Is there anything you can share about how you're going to be spending your time this year?
Love to say I'm starting 10 new companies, but right now I'm focusing on Product Perfect and building enterprise software. So if you have an enterprise software need, conversion, a mainframe that needs ripping out and replacing it with modern technology, take a look at our work at productperfect.com. But other than that, I do have a list of about 27 startups that I'd like to start. So if you'd like to hand me a couple mil, we'll get right to work.
Love it. And for anyone listening that would like to find out more about your Amazon best-selling business nonfiction book, Average Joe, or reach out and contact you personally, what's the best way of finding you online and that book, of course?
Yeah, averagejoetechgenius.com, slowcreate.com, the software company's productperfect.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Sean Livermore. My handle is ShawneePants. And I'm on LinkedIn as well, Sean Livermore.
Excellent. Well, I'll add all the links to the blog post that will promote this episode so people can find you nice and easily. I do urge people to check the book out. It is a great read, especially because you bust so many myths that have held people back for so long. So that's something we can all shout about a little bit more. But more than anything, just thank you for spending a bit of time with me today.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Neil.
What I love about this book is how it provides hard evidence that anyone in tech can create and anyone outside of tech can break through to the center where innovation, creativity, and opportunity meet. And it's also great to hear anecdotes, stories, evidence, facts, arguments, logic, principles, and techniques provided in the book that have helped individuals and businesses engage in that slow creation cycle needed to improve the morale of their development teams and increase their delivery potential of the technology solutions overall. Certainly one to check out or add to your reading list. But if you do read it, remember to report back to me and let me know your honest opinion. That is what this podcast is about. So please email me, techblogwriter@outlook.com. Tweet me at Neil C. Hughes. My website is techblogwriter.co.uk. Let me know what you thought, and I'll meet you here again tomorrow. So a big thank you for listening. And until next time, don't be a stranger.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Talks Daily Podcast with Neil C. Hughes. Remember, technology works best when it brings people together.